papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis where you get some veteran journalists talking to you about newsroom decision making, the perils confronting the industry, and maybe some darn nice gossip about journalism. It's a good thing. I'm Rex Smith, former editor of the Times Union, here with Judy Patrick, the former editor of the Daily Gazette.
I'm here for the gossip.
Yeah, that's good. And the jelly donuts, right? And Ian Pickus, the news director for Northeast Public Radio.
If David and I are on here, then who's in the newsroom?
Oh, no. David Gustina is here, our producer.
Only because I have to be.
I'm sorry, David. You tell us when to show up, and it's very nice of you to come as well.
And to answer Ian's question, no one is in the newsroom.
No, I should note, there's plenty of people in that newsroom.
That's
you do
right.
A pretty good job of staffing the news.
Absolutely so. We're very glad that you take a little bit of time here to be with us to talk about the media. We're going to talk about speakers today. That is speakers of the House and of the Assembly. Speaker Mike Johnson of the U.S. House of Representatives and the Speaker Carl Hastie of the New York State Assembly. First, let's just talk about Mike Johnson. Went to Columbia University to denounce the student protesters. What's wrong with Speaker Mike Johnson? What does it say about journalism there? What's the point here?
Yeah, he went to Columbia not for class, but for the photo op, right?
Yeah, right. What was the point?
That's a very good question. Why did Mike Johnson feel that he needed to stand on the quad in front of Lowell Library and denounce? What did he think would be beneficial in that?
Well, you know what? He did get some play. That's why he did it. He seized the day. He got a little air time. He got a little press time. But does the Speaker of the House of Representatives have anything to do with what happens at Columbia in terms of protests or in terms of where they donate their money or invest their money?
And when he shows up at the university, should he have read their memos that were sent out in which they didn't say what he alleges they said, which is for Jewish students to stay home?
Right. He claimed that the university had sent out memos telling Jewish students to stay home and that this was outright discriminatory because, well, if you're Jewish, maybe you want to stay home. That is not, in fact, what the university said. And we owe it to PolitiFact, actually, one of the fact-checking outfits that has now taken hold in journalism, for pointing out that the speaker was speaking incorrectly.
Well, and is there anything that isn't in a political context when it's the Speaker of the House showing up on a campus which is embroiled in protests about a very, very controversial and complicated subject like Israel and the Hamas war?
And what can you do if you're a journalist? Don't you have to cover? I mean, this is part of what we've often said about Donald Trump when he says outrageous stuff. You have to cover it, though. And unfortunately, there wasn't immediate pushback from the reporters who covered this saying, well, wait a minute, that's not what was actually said. It took PolitiFact to nail that down.
Is that because it's so politically fraught and that journalists often are afraid to cover issues like this because no matter what you do, even if you think you're giving it a fair shot, there will be pushback no matter what.
You know, I said that on our morning meeting today. We ran a feature story a couple of days ago about a New York / Israeli who survived the Hamas attack on October 7th at the music festival. And he's been telling his story at colleges on the East Coast. And I am also assigned here at the station to go through our listener comments, which we air every Friday. And there was a lot of backlash to that segment as being a pro-Israel piece of propaganda that we ran, despite being this first-person account that was very powerful. We've also obviously covered these protests, and some of the conversations we're having as a department are based on the fact that college students protest all the time. David and I are at the university at Albany. It's not a regular day there if people aren't marching around and banging pots and pans on the quad. That's kind of what they do at college. So as reporters, when you are amplifying a protest, that is a choice. And what we've been talking about here is, okay, if every college campus in America is going to have a protest about the Israel-Gaza campaign, what makes it newsworthy? Is the fact that the protest is going on newsworthy? Is it if the protesters are breaking school rules? Is it if the police are being called in to clear them? When does it escalate? And it's very similar to talks we had in 2020 and 2021 during the BLM uprisings. You know, when is a protest just kind of par for the course? Here in Albany, where we're speaking, I've seen these lovely folks protesting American imperialism downtown like every Friday for as long as I've been aware of them. So is that news? And these are the conversations that are going on right now.
And also, I'll add to what Ian said about the station. You've got that criticism that came on the listener comment line, but we've often over the years heard lots of criticism of the BBC and the way they report on the Israel-Palestinian situation.
Oh, you guys should crack down on the BBC. I mean, they're going to really want to hear what you guys
have to say.
Call
the listener comment line. But it's true. We get it from both sides.
And it's true. When you're running a local news operation, you will get the calls from the people who are running the protests saying, why aren't you here?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
And this is important. We have a lot of people out. And you have to make that determination. What makes this stand out? What is different about this? And at this point, with the college campus protests, there seem to be growing in number, and maybe that's why it's getting the focus that it is at this point. We will see how it turns out in the next week or so.
And there's a question of instigators. This is the part that is also somewhat fraught. You know, are there actual instigators that are in these crowds causing problems? I heard a report this morning that they supposedly identified one, but, you know, it looks to be mostly student.
Yeah, although to help people understand that, too, the average age of student at Columbia University, where a lot of the protest took off, is 25. Mm. That is an interesting fact. So now, I was on the Columbia campus, and at the time of that encampment, this is now 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, by the time most people will hear this, most of the protesters were undergraduates. They were young people. And the din was quite annoying, but interestingly, the demonstrations fired up, the demonstrations outside the gate, literally outside agitators, outside the campus gate, those fired up at the time of the live broadcast, of course. You know, when 5 o'clock yeah. comes and the stations go live, New York local news, that's when you suddenly heard a lot louder protests outside. So we know that we are being played, we as journalists. We know that these demonstrations exist because they want us to pick them up. And the question that often comes, especially a place like Albany, is how big a demonstration is big enough to cover it?
Yeah.
In the case of the state capitol during budget season, you know, you need to have at least a couple of thousand people before you think that it's worth covering, right?
Every Tuesday is a protest
yeah.
day, you know,
mm-hmm.
that's just kind of baked into the schedule.
Yeah.
And how do we frame protests? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? It seems to be tainted sort of negatively, in my opinion, mm-hmm. when in fact you could argue that, you know, we constantly criticize young people for not paying attention and not being engaged. And here we see basically a practicum course on the university campuses in civil disobedience.
Cool. Now, we promised that we were going to talk about two speakers, the other speaker being Carl Hasty, the speaker of the New York State Assembly, whose communications team during the pandemic set up barriers so that there were no longer opportunities available for reporters to come onto the floor of the New York State Assembly. And now those still exist, despite formal requests from the New York State Legislative Correspondents Association and a rules change request from Republicans. It still means that reporters can no longer go into the chamber. You can't get behind the speaker's podium, which is where the Democrats caucus. It's where the speaker's offices are. And basically the public, as well as reporters, are now locked out of that. So the question is why the inhibition of access. And I do want to make one other point. The speaker's communications team claims that nothing has changed, that reporters never had been allowed on the floor. That's not true. That is what we call in this business a lie.
Including photographs they were sending to show them that they were on yeah. the floor talking yeah. to the lawmakers in
yeah.
the past.
I've spent a lot of time on that floor. Not on the floor. You understand what colloquially.
We know exactly what you mean.
And there's a secondary issue, which is that the Assembly and Senate have different rules set by individual houses about how the committee meetings will be streamed or not. So, yes, COVID was a chance for a lot of cracking down on access that has not been fully restored, even in 2024. And I will add one separate issue related to Speaker Hasty himself, which is there was great reporting done by our colleague Chris Bragg on the fact that Speaker Hasty has a romantic relationship mm-hmm. with somebody who is involved in lobbying New York state government. And Hasty did not want to talk about that with reporters. And he told them, I will never talk about my private life ever again in a testy exchange during this particular legislative session. So it's
apparently
a public,
even when it intersects with his public duties.
Sure, public person in a public setting who has a public profile, who does not want to talk about his private life.
Is it a private life when it's a lobbyist?
Exactly.
That is not a private matter. And reporters need to keep asking him that question, by the way. Credit to Chris Bragg, formerly of the Times Union. I would like to brag about that. I hired him. And now
you're bragging about Bragg?
Indeed, he is.
New York Focus, this wonderful not-for-profit newsroom.
But if you're a legislator, why would you?
Why would you
give him access back?
Oh,
you know, they're not stupid. They're like, wow, hey, let's not let them back on the floor.
Because you're there to serve the public.
Oh,
and then
right.
Reporters are the eyes and the ears of the public. I mean, this may sound like a small thing to the average person,
right.
But physical access to elected representatives is crucial, especially when it's so hard to get them in other venues. I mean, anybody who's ever covered a city council or a town board meeting knows that to be physically there, to be able to pull somebody aside and ask that follow-up question is essential to accurate reporting.
Now, sports reporters have encountered this forever. For one thing, it used to inhibit women sports reporters because they weren't allowed into locker rooms and there would be banter and there would be reporting by the guys. Then the women started being allowed into locker rooms and you can imagine what all ensued. But now there is a lot of pushback. For example, I'm just reading about the University of Southern California, which suspended access from an Orange County Register reporter because that reporter reported remarks made outside official team media availability. So you're not allowed to interview an elite athlete unless the team tells you it's okay? This can't be right.
No, you get a lot of that with even the public relations people that represent colleges. They say, you have to go through us in order to get to the professor for that interview. Well, no, I don't. I can get to the professor directly. I don't need you. Thank you.
Or even the public relations people that work in city halls or town board meetings. Public officials or public employees get in trouble when they talk directly to the press. It's something that's increasingly happened the last 10 years, and it's to the detriment of the public's ability to know things.
The advice that I give our staff here is that you should be respectful of the person whose job it is to run interference, to flack, because we're going to have to live to fight another day, and we're going to need to call on them at a certain time, and we're going to want to respect the role that they play, but have in your back pocket the fact that, yeah, I've got the mayor's number, and if it's important enough, I will call them directly and apologize for it later. So that's what we try to do, and we just had a breakthrough with a local elected official who had shut us out for the first 4 or 5 months of their term, showing up to the meeting to get on this person's radar and to show that we were serious. Finally led to a breakthrough that would not have happened if it was just leaving a message with the assigned flack.
It is much harder nowadays. Everybody has gotten accustomed to, everybody in public relations has gotten accustomed to demanding that you email your questions and that you only deal with the press office. And reporters, for example, in the New York State Capitol cannot get access to places where, when I was a reporter there 30 years ago, it was easy. You could go to the second floor where the governor's office suite was and you could wander into offices and talk to people. No longer can you do that.
What can we do about that? The WAMC approach is to try to reconnect with people on a personal level is one thing you can do. But also, I almost wish we would say, no, we as an industry would say, we're not going to send you the email questions anymore. We want to really talk to you. I don't think that was ever going to happen because it's easier to send email questions. But how do you know they're actually responding to the email and the flack isn't?
You know, we had a very tough story that we ran this week on a local boarding school that has allegations of sexual misconduct on the part of faculty in our listening area. And we made the point that, look, by not participating in the story, by answering only email questions, by definition, the story is going to sound unbalanced against you. It's not because you're choosing to send written answers, but we're hearing the voices of people who were contemporaneous students, and we're not hearing your voice in the piece. That's a decision that they make, and I think a lot of people say, hey, if I participate, it's a loser for us anyway, so I'm not going to. But especially in an audio medium like this one, if you're missing from that story, it doesn't sound fair to you.
Audio makes it especially hard for radio, I think. The great example, of course, is Elise Stefanik, who refuses to speak to most news outlets. She will go on to Fox News, of course, but she won't speak here to WAMC, I presume. But you've had newscasts recently where you've had what is essentially canned audio that she sends out, which is the same thing as a press release. It's like in print, you just quote a comment from a press release.
Yeah, and we should compliment Ian in the newsroom for making sure that we get that, because we're always trying to make sure we have something from her. We don't want to avoid it. We make it very clear she won't come on, that we ask her for it. But when we do, Ian's constantly watching. When are these congressional folks going to be speaking? And especially if Stefanik's going to put her voice out there, we want to have it.
Yeah. So it's a real effort to be fair. And yet she bypasses accountability that the media presents. It's really hard.
And almost in not even recognizing that there's a certain amount of, even if it's just goodwill, that you came on and shared your perspective on your public radio station. She might not get a lot of converts to her side of the aisle, but I don't think it could hurt her, really.
You would think. By the way, before we leave the chamber of the New York State Assembly, we should say a word here about Karen DeWitt. Don't you think? This great veteran reporter who has covered for this station and the others in New York State for more than 30 years.
Yeah.
Is actually retiring, leaving the beat. How amazing is that?
We're really going to miss Karen. It's sad news. I think everyone in the New York State government and media bubble that we're in just had nothing but great things to say about her professionalism over the years, the experience she's had through multiple governors and speakers and elections and issues, up to the point where she covered New York's first female governor as a trailblazer in the Legislative Correspondents Association. And you talk about institutional knowledge. You know, you don't see a lot of people now in press corps in state capitals who are, you know, finishing their careers there. So we're going to lose a lot by her retiring, but we're, of course, very happy for her.
So well said. I mean, that institutional memory is so valuable when you don't have it. She is going to be so missed, not only at WAMC, but throughout the public radio system in New York. I became so used to, as I think so many of us, the sound of her voice leading the newscasts when it came to New York State government and politics. And she, in her own right, for New York State Public Radio, was like a Barbara Walters or a Walter Cronkite type of a news person that I think most people, when they heard her voice, there was an instant level of trust in what she was saying.
Mm-hmm. You know, and Ian makes a good point. There used to be people like that in state capitals. Yeah. I remember when I was a young newspaper guy in Indiana, UPI had Hortense Myers, who spent her career, and she knew everything in Indianapolis. She could just dictate a story off the top of her head. It was terrific. Or in Washington, the AP's Helen Thomas, later a colleague of mine at Hearst Newspapers, was a similar institution. You don't have a lot of institutions like that anymore. People tend to leave and move along or leave journalism entirely for something more profitable. So Karen's really a wonderful example of great career at this place.
Congratulations to you, Karen.
How about that? Okay, while we're talking about public radio, since we are on public radio, we know that the people who listen here care about it, or else you wouldn't be here. Thank you very much. And by the way, if you want to share your views, media@wamc.org is how you can send us email. So we need to go back to this question that we've been covering for a while. The senior editor from NPR, Uri Berliner, who wrote a piece harshly critiquing the internal situation at NPR, claiming that an approach that had generated what he determined to be overly liberal coverage was imperiling it. Uri has since left NPR. And now the question is, what's really going on there? And is there a solution to what the New York Times called the crisis at NPR? What might happen next? What issues really are underlying? Is Uri's criticism valid from the get-go?
I will tell you, I'm excited to take part in a scoping session that's planned with stations and NPR in the coming days to talk about how we go forward from this point and hearing critiques from member stations and decision making. But I will say this, and I don't want to sound jaded, but having been at WAMC for 15 years now, this is like the fourth or fifth time I remember us confronting a crisis in the public media system. And I just think it's always going to be the case that it's not a perfect system and it's a body that is constantly hearing criticism and responding to criticism and trying to be better. I think that this Berliner op-ed kind of lit a fuse, and there's a separate fact right now, which is that across the board, revenues are down, underwriting is down, and member stations are making cuts to make ends meet. So NPR being in a moment of crisis is reflected at the local level, and I worry about how that will affect bottom lines as we're going forward now.
I really agree with that, Ian. I thought that that was one of the biggest things. To me, the inside, the NPR crisis, the New York Times deep dive was really informative in terms of those numbers and really understanding what's affecting us and how we're not immune from what commercial media is facing as well. But when it comes to NPR, my criticism is not about its wokeness or really anything in the Uri Berliner category. It's more about their birthright, which is investigative journalism.
Ah.
And this morning we're hearing a story, and I don't have a problem with you doing music reviews, but I don't care what P. Diddy and Drake think about a song or if they're in a war together. I care more about what's happening in Israel and Hamas or what's happening in our country when it comes to the coming election or the environmental crisis we face or what's going on in our healthcare system. Instead, NPR is trying to please an audience that I don't think is really tuned in. They're not listening in that traditional terrestrial radio way. And what is better for NPR than to break news, to draw attention to itself for its great journalism, which is why people gravitated toward it in the first place?
So you're saying that NPR, in trying to reach the younger audience, the more diverse audience, is going for people they're never going to get anyway.
And they're abandoning their mission in a way.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And that criticism we've heard from some experts in the
field. I listened to the Drake piece too, and I understand that they're trying to reach a different audience. But as a baby boomer person, I thought to myself, well, maybe I do need to know more about the rap music industry, and maybe this is good for me to know. So I was open-minded to it. But one thing that I have been watching with NPR is its relationships to its affiliates. It started recently having a button on its homepage where you can donate directly to NPR.
Yes.
Now, there's a provision there that says, you know, we love our affiliates, don't forget our affiliates. But this is something new, and I worry that in the long run, this is going to hurt stations like WAMC.
At the risk of telling tales out of school, I think I can say safely, there is a perception on NPR's part that whatever is good for NPR trickles down to the member stations and is good for the member stations. If NPR is doing well, then the member stations are doing well. If NPR is doing good work, then the member stations can bask in that. And what you're talking about, Judy, is a notable change. They're saying, hey, let us worry about attracting major donations. Give us access to your donor rolls, and let's see if we can build this quote-unquote NPR network together. And the devil is always in the details. If a station like ours or WBUR or some of the stations out west has its bottom line in danger, if we're running, 25% behind on revenues, then it makes it much harder to pay the NPR bill in the long run. So we need every click we can get to come to member stations.
It would dilute our local identity as well from those underwriters that support and know us as WAMC. And now if it's going through NPR, and we're really kind of bypassed in that way. We lose some of our identity that way.
One of the suggestions that has emerged from Dick Toefel, who is one of the, let's say, graybeards of journalism, a founder of Politico and a number of other things, Dick put forward the proposition that NPR should voluntarily step forward and say, okay, take away the public funding. This is where people have a misunderstanding, really, of public broadcasting and think that both the local stations and NPR get a lot of money from taxpayers. In fact, it's not so. NPR News derives 1% of its income from the federal government. And so when you have all these Republican representatives in Congress saying, well, taxpayers are supporting this woke notion, give up that money. Let that go, say, back to the local stations to support the local journalism infrastructure that is imperiled by the decline in contributions. And then let NPR find its way without that 1%. It would be a good step forward anyway to be divorced from the Congress, let's say.
Well, it might stop the annual threats of removing the money from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Right.
The thing that would happen, though, also, is stations that are a fraction of the size of WAMC would disappear. If you're talking about a small amount of money for a station that's one guy with a soundboard, that's a much different conversation.
Right. We have an example of that in Robin Hood Radio, which I think is in Sharon, Connecticut, just across the state.
Well, I would argue most of the public stations across the country are small stations like that.
And
we're
they're
the
in
anomaly.
News deserts, too. Yeah, they're in places that don't have a lot of other news off.
So the access to the public money really makes a difference for them.
It can.
Absolutely.
I mean, if your budget is small, then 1% of a small amount is a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And this, I'm sure, we'll be hearing more about. But it's important for us to understand the value that these entities bring as as all of the little newsrooms around the country do. You know, we hear about big organizations, not so much the little ones, which are really the core of news coverage for communities. They don't have anywhere else to go. I want to bring up just one more issue before we run out of time here, because the conversation's been going on. We have a major newspaper, the Dallas Morning News, has hired a public editor. You may not think this is a big deal, because if you are an aficionado of the Media Project, you've probably been paying attention to the media for a long time, and you think, yeah, newsrooms have public editors. That is, somebody who watches out for public opinion, who is somewhat independent of the newsroom.
A reader representative, right?
A reader representative, or ombudsman, they were called, have disappeared, most famously from the New York Times. Now, the Dallas Morning News is a major newspaper, one of the 10 largest in the country, I believe, still, and they are hiring a public editor. Is this a time for us to say we need to have a resurgence of that kind of an opportunity for people to have a voice? How else do people actually intersect with the media?
Clearly, this is an effort to restore trust, because polls have shown people's trust in their news operation has declined precipitously in the last decade. This new editor is going to write once a month. I'm not sure how productive that's going to be. At least once a month, I guess, is better than zero times a month. But it is an effort to explain what happens in the newspaper. And editors themselves can do it, but having someone disassociated with the newsroom increases the level of trust people can put in what they write.
Yeah, I should point out that NPR uses Kelly McBride, the head of the ethics faculty at the Poynter Institute, as their public editor still. And the Times Union has an editor called Reader Representative. Tina Tyler has long held that role, but she does report to the editor, so that's a little bit different from being outside and independent. Nevertheless, having some focus of where people can go to have a voice inside the newsroom seems like an important thing. We're out of time.
Wow.
Isn't that something? How about that? Wasn't that fun? Okay.
No gossip. Not one shred of gossip.
Can I criticize that decision as the show ombudsman?
There you go. All right. That's David Gustina, our producer, who was here on mic this time. Ian Pickus, the news director of Northeast Public Radio. Judy Patrick, vice president of the New York Press Association and formerly editor of the Daily Gazette. And I'm Rex Smith of the Upstate American. We thank you for joining us this week on The Media Project.
Publishers of such interesting...
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Substack columnist of the Upstate American, Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette and vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association, WAMC news director Ian Pickus, and me, David Gustina, producer of The Media Project, will also sit on the panel this week. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.
What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.